This is the tax update for January 14, 2008. This week, economic substance, promissory notes, and partnerships. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm matters raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information. Tax practitioners that subscribe to their services, visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. This week, the IRS goes after a partnership liquidation transaction and ends up not succeeding in convincing the tax court that the transaction in question lacked economic substance, or that the taxpayers in question received what were the equivalent of cash or cash available on demand when they got redeemed for their partnership interest. The case in question is a case of Countryside Limited Partnership versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2008-3. In this particular case, the IRS attempted to apply the general concept of economic substance of the transaction, as well as specifically apply two partnership anti-abuse provisions found in Regulation Section 1.701-2 and Regulation 1.731-28 to recharacterize the transaction as a taxable transaction to the departing partners, or claim the side agreement, in the IRS view, changed the promissory notes received as part of this liquidation transaction into marketable securities per Section 731(c)(1)(b), and in that case meant that the taxpayers had, in their distribution, received the equivalent of cash, which would have caused the transaction to be a taxable transaction at that time. The IRS was unsuccessful on all counts, and the case provides some interesting insight into the application of the various provisions regarding tax-motivated transactions and how they impact partnership taxation. Now, before going into the case, it's important to review the general partnership rules and partnership distribution rules so that you have a groundwork of how the case goes against the law. A number of us, you know, partnership law is considered some of the more complicated area of tax laws, but the interesting part in partnership taxation is that in one sense, it tries to take a very simple concept of letting the partnership get out of the way and looking through to tax individuals, and tries to take that simple concept and then apply it, but has to have a bunch of special provisions added on top of what would be otherwise relatively simple provisions in order to prevent abusive transactions. And that's why we get the what many consider to be the mess we have in partnership taxation law, and why it is so complex and so difficult at times to get your head around. Now, the general rule for taxation of a distribution to a partner is governed by Section 731. And it provides that in the case of a distribution by a partnership to a partner, gain shall not be recognized to the partner, except to the extent that money distributed exceeds the adjusted basis of such partner's interest in the partnership immediately before the distribution. Now, basically, that sounds pretty simple. We just look at, did they get cash? If they got cash, is the cash in excess of the basis? If the cash is in excess of the basis, then we have taxable gain. If not, we don't. And the general rule is that we have a carryover basis after that point. But the code complicates matters through definitions. The catch is we find, for purposes of Section 731, money is not just that green stuff, the Federal Reserve notes. Money includes a couple of other things that you wouldn't maybe initially think of as money. One key importance is Section 752B. And that tells us that if there is a decrease in the partner's share of liabilities of a partnership, or any decrease in individual liabilities by reason that the partnership assumes a debt of the partner, that shall be considered a distribution of money. As we know, under 731A, a distribution of money is what can trigger a gain. So there's one way to do it. Secondly, Section 731C provides an expansion of the definition of cash to include marketable securities in most cases. And that tells us that basically for purposes of Section 731A1, the gain provision, and Section 737, the term money includes marketable securities, and such securities shall be taken into account at their fair market value as of the date of distribution. Now, this is not an absolute. There are some qualifying situations where pure marketable securities will not trigger application of the section. But the general rule is for a run-of-the-mill partnership, if you get marketable securities rather than getting cash, that's not going to eliminate the gain situation. What that does is prevent the partnership from going out just before it liquidates you out. And instead of giving you $200,000 in cash, we give you $200,000 of United States Treasury notes, basically something very solid and very likely to pay off, fully marketable at the fair value at the date as of the same value as you would have received in cash. Basically, the provision stops an end run. Now, that particular issue, though, brings up others that what's marketable securities is defined more broadly to stop another end run. Okay, well, rather than U.S. Treasury bonds, maybe I give you a note from some other party, but the note from the other party provides that at your demand, they will provide you with those U.S. Treasury bonds instead of that. So the note says that at any point, you as a holder of the note can demand that the other party substitute U.S. Treasury bonds, in essence, for the note that you now have from them. So Section 731C2BII provides that any financial instrument which, pursuant to its terms or other arrangement, is readily convertible into or exchangeable for money or marketable securities. So essentially, if I have one where on demand I can readily convert over into marketable securities or cash, then that's also counted as a distribution of cash for these purposes. Now, that's the basic distribution rule. So summarize what those tell us is generally, if we don't get cash and we don't get something like the cash-like items of either the reduction of liabilities in excess of our basis, you know, reduction of liabilities, I should say, or we don't get marketable securities, but we add up all those cash things and they're less than our basis. And remember on the debt side of the equation, remember that for partnership purposes, our allocable share of debt created basis for us. So therefore, you know, you have to remember when you do that calculation of release of debt, you also have to look at the debt basis that may still be remaining for the partner. But even at the end of the day, we do that calculation. If we end up with still a positive number, there's no gain on our distribution to us, even if that distribution is in liquidation. Now, I will also note as an aside, not to be covered today, but generally, except in limited cases, you also don't trigger a loss if you receive anything other than cash, receivables, and inventory in distribution from the partnership and liquidation of your interest. So it works both ways. The theory of this being, remember, the point of the partnership was to try to get the partnership out of the way and treat it as if you were just kind of the individual owner of what was underlying your interest. We also should be aware that these distributions can cause another issue with hot assets. That's another issue we're not considering today, which is meant to prevent conversion of capital of what would be ordinary income into capital gain. As I said, partnership law is a bunch of simple cases followed by a whole bunch of complicating exceptions. But let's keep our eye on the case for today and let's go on to the next problem. Now, so we know the basics of what would cause a distribution to be taxable. However, even if a transaction complies with all the literal rules, there are two anti-abuse provisions that it may run afoul of. First, we have the rule at Section 701- the Regulation 701-2, the General Anti-Abuse Provisions of Subchapter K. And that provides, in general, that if a partnership is formed or availed of in connection with a transaction, the principal purpose of which is to reduce substantially the present value of the partner's aggregate federal tax liability in a manner that is inconsistent with the intent of subchapter K, the commissioner can recast the transactions for federal income tax purposes. And the reg at 1.701-2B goes on to note that even though the transaction may fall within the literal words of a particular statutory or regulatory provision, the commissioner still has the right to determine based on the facts and circumstances that it's going to restructure the transaction for tax reporting purposes. Now, that's the general one, but for distributions, there's a special provision for Section 731C to prevent the distribution, to prevent anti-abuse transactions there where we're trying to get around that marketable security rules. And in that case, Reg 1.731-2H provides that the provision of Section 731C in this section must be applied in a manner consistent with the purpose of Section 731C and the substance of the transaction. It goes on to tell me if the principal purpose of the transaction is to achieve a tax result that's inconsistent with the purpose of Section 731C in this section, again, the commissioner can recast the whole thing. Finally, even ignoring those two, the IRS has the more general ability to make use of the economic substance doctrine to remove tax benefits if the underlying transactions taken as a whole don't have economic substance. That is, effectively, the only thing happening from an economic perspective is that taxes are being reduced, but nothing else really fundamentally changes economically. In this case, the IRS cited the 1965 Second Court affirmation of the tax court holding in the case of Goldstein versus Commissioner. In that case, the tax court summarized the Goldstein facts as follows. In the Goldstein case, Mrs. Goldstein won over $140,000 in the IRS sweepstakes. In an effort to mitigate the tax impact of having to report all of her winnings in the year of receipt, she was advised to construct a plan pursuant to which, before the end of the year, she borrowed $945,000 from two banks, purchased $1 million face amount Treasury 1.5% notes, and prepaid 4% interest for 1.5 years on one bank loan and for approximately 2.75 years on the other. The total interest payments were over $81,000, which the Goldsteins claimed as a deduction to your payment under Section 163A. The tax court denied the deduction on the ground there was no genuine indebtedness between the bank and Mrs. Goldstein. On appeals, the second court affirmed, but for a different purpose. It agreed with the opinion, the dissenting opinion of the court, the bank loans were indistinguishable from any other legitimate loan transaction contracted for purchase of government securities, and found that the tax court was in error, concluding those loans were shams, which created no general indebtedness. It agreed, however, with the finding that Mrs. Goldstein entered into the two bank loans without any realistic expectation of economic profit and solely to secure a large interest deduction. The court found that Congress intended to limit interest deductions under Section 163A, interest on debt incurred for purposive activity, and it held that the section did not permit a deduction for interest paid by Mrs. Goldstein, where the sole purpose of borrowings was to generate tax-deductible interest. So the key point there was, in that case, they found that the only reason the transaction been entered into was to generate tax-deductible interest, and there was no underlying economics to it. In fact, the transaction made no sense, absent the fact that the tax savings were there. There was no possibility of a profit aside from the fact of the tax savings that Mrs. Goldstein got from pushing her income into a future year. Because she could not profit for the transaction, again, as noted, no substance. That was true even though the Second Circuit effectively found she dotted every I, crossed every T, met all the requirements of the code. The IRS has this ability to argue that a transaction that effectively has no reason for being aside from the tax benefits can be ignored for tax purposes. Now we consider the actual case of the Countryside case and what was going on in this one. The case is a bit involved, but we can roughly summarize the facts as we note them in the materials. The partnership had an appreciated piece of real estate it was planning on selling. In fact, it had already been contacted by the entity that would be the eventual buyer of the property in April of the year in question, and was in the process of getting ready to sell this piece of property, a piece of property it would sell early the following year. Two of the partners apparently did not want to pay tax currently on the gains when the property was sold. So to accomplish that goal, the partnership decided to find a way to get them out of the partnership before the sale took place in a way that would not be taxable to those two individuals. Now, Mr. Wynn had two corporations under his control, and they formed new LLCs. One was CLP Promisee LLC, which is called CLPP for this purpose, and the other was Manchester Promisee LLC, MP. Okay. Each corporation acquired a 1% interest in the underlying LLC for cash. The other partner in CLPP's case was Countrywide. So Countrywide, the existing limited partnership, became a partner with one of Mr. Wynn's corporations in CLP Promise LLC. Countrywide borrowed $8.55 million from Columbus Bank and Trust, contributed that to CLPP in exchange for a 99% interest. CLPP then contributed $8.5 million of that cash to Manchester Promisee, or MP, in exchange for the remaining 99% interest in that LLC. So we have two levels of LLC here, but essentially the old partnership borrowed over $8.5 million and loaned it to the partnership. That partnership then went ahead and, or not loaned it, but contributed to the partnership. That partnership went ahead and then contributed that $8.5 million, or most of that money, to another partnership. So we have these two partnerships sitting there, or these two LLCs, which are taxes partnerships. MP then borrowed an additional $3.4 million from Columbus Bank and Trust. Now, I'm going to warn you, the reason for this transaction is going to eventually come down to wanting to make sure that our people, that our individuals did not, at the end of the day in the transactions, have a net relief of liability in excess of their basis. That's the reason. Otherwise, this $3.4 million borrowing seems to be really weird as to why this is going on, but that's the point. Both Columbus Bank and Trust loans, one made by Countrywide and the one asked for by MP directly, were guaranteed by Mr. Wynn. And the loan to Countrywide was secured by the Manchester property. That's that appreciated piece of real estate we're going to talk about from earlier. The Countrywide loan had a due date Countrywide loan had a due date of May 1st of the following year. And the MP loan was due 2 years and 11 months after it was taken out. Now, at that point, MP, which you have to remember now, actually just had the cash, and most of the cash at this point, used that cash to buy four promissory notes issued by AIG Matching Funds Corporation of $11.5 million. Each of the notes paid an interest rate that was lower than the rates being paid on the bank notes that were effectively being used to purchase them. And provided if the holders of more than 50% of the note principal agreed, the terms could be modified by the parties. A security interest was given to Columbus Bank and Trust in two of the notes that totaled $3.4 million to secure MP's note with the bank. From the IRS's perspective, they thought they had Mrs. Goldstein here. Exactly that fact pattern in their view. At December 26, 2000, Countryside distributed its 99% interest in CLPP to Mr. Wynn and Mr. Curtis in complete liquidation of their partnership interests. While there was relief from debt as part of the transaction, Mr. Wynn and Mr. Curtis recognized the new debt to Columbus Bank and Trust they took on as part of the overall transaction, and thus were not deemed to receive a distribution in cash in the form of reduction of debt in excess of their basis in Countryside, even though they now had very little basis remaining. In January of 2001, Countryside sold the Manchester property to the buyer with whom the partnership had been negotiating since May or June of 2000. Following that date, Countryside repaid its loans to Columbus Bank and Trust. AIG redeemed the notes from M&P in April 2003, and the MP loan to Columbus Bank and Trust was repaid in early 2004. Now, Mr. Wynn and Mr. Curtis treated that distribution of LLC member interest to them as distribution of property and liquidation of their partnership interest. As such, they recognized no gain on the receipt of these interests pursuant to the general rule we find in Section 731A, and they took a carryover basis in the member interest that tied to their ending basis just before redemption in Countryside pursuant to Section 732B. That remaining basis was very small, but they did have that, and so we effectively deferred the gain down the line. Countryside treated the liquidating distribution as a distribution triggering the application of Section 734, thus stepping up the partnership's basis in the assets of the partnership. As you may guess, the IRS wasn't thrilled with that result either. So here we had the money going out the door. When the property actually is sold by Countryside, they're going to reduce their gain by the amount that these two would have recognized, but these two aren't recognizing any gain until well down the line. So the IRS thought this is obviously just a pure tax avoidance structure, and the IRS's theory was this needs to be squashed now. The IRS objected to it in total. As noted, it viewed the entire device as a mechanism to avoid transaction. In the alternative, if the tax court wouldn't go along and say the whole transaction was just a sham that was meant to avoid taxes and it was the only purpose, they viewed the notes from AIG as window dressing for which there was an agreement that the notes were redeemable in cash whenever those outgoing partners decided they wanted the funds via an understanding that existed at the time the transaction was entered into. Now, the taxpayers admitted that the exact structure they formed to accomplish their goal was selected due to the tax effect it gave them. So there was no question that, you know, this particular structure, which is a bit involved and complicated, was selected because it would give them a positive tax benefit. But they claimed that there were other factors that did not allow the IRS to disregard this transaction, nor did they agree the AIG notes were effectively ones that were convertible to cash on demand. Now, the IRS goes for economic substance first. The IRS observes, in their view, the partnership borrowed funds, used them to purchase debt obligations that paid a lower interest rate than was due on the underlying notes. A transaction had no possibility of being profitable, just like the transaction Mrs. Goldstein entered into. The tax court did not agree. Tax court indicated the IRS made a fundamental mistake in its use of the Goldstein case, noted that the IRS's reliance on Goldstein founders on the fact that Countryside, rather than Mr. Wynn and Mr. Curtis, occupies Mrs. Goldstein's position, paying more interest on the borrowing than was received on the investment purchase of those borrowings. The comparable issue in this case would be whether Countryside is entitled to deduct the interest paid on the loans from CB&T. The IRS has not raised an issue, an interest deductibility issue in this case, and there is nothing on that score for us to resolve. However, the court notes the mere fact the IRS may have chosen the wrong case to go after in support of their position for economic substance did not render the issue moot. There's still the issue that regards to the fact that Goldstein is inapplicable, whether Mr. Wynn and Mr. Curtis engage in a purposive activity other than tax avoidance. Failing to find such an activity would present circumstances that would negate the application of Section 731A1 and 751A, 752A and B to provide non-recognition of gain to Mr. Wynn and Mr. Curtis on this distribution. In Note 20 to the case, the tax court explains there are two prongs that it needs to apply in this particular case, one of which must be met in order for the transaction to be found of economic substance. It either must meet the objective prong that there is a change in the taxpayer's economic position following the transaction other than via simply the tax savings that would result, or the subjective prong, that is, there is a legitimate non-tax reason for entering into the transaction. The court found that there was something that fundamentally changed the economic interest aside from the tax impact. The court noted, in this case, what occurred was a distribution of non-marketable notes and redemption of limited partnership interest. Countryside undertook the distribution in order to eliminate Mr. Wynn and Mr. Curtis as limited partners. The court doesn't say so, but arguably, since they didn't want to recognize the gain, they may very well have objected to the sale going through otherwise. And the other partners could have been stuck with having to hold on to the property, so we needed to eliminate these two as partners. We had legitimate non-business reasons for wanting them out of the mix so that we could go ahead and finish up our sale without these guys objecting. They didn't want to pay tax this year. Mr. Wynn and Mr. Curtis agreed to the redemption in order to convert their interest in Countryside into interest-bearing promissory notes. All the parties to the transaction had legitimate business purposes, and the manner in which those parties accomplished those purposes cannot be disregarded and converted by a respondent into a transaction, an exchange of Mr. Wynn and Mr. Curtis's interest in Countryside for cash that never occurred simply because the transaction that did occur was tax motivated, or as we stated in Hobby versus Commissioner, had a collateral favorable tax effect. Moreover, that transaction changed Mr. Wynn and Mr. Curtis's economic position, thereby satisfying both prongs of economic substance doctrine. Likewise, the transaction changed the economic position of Countryside and its remaining partners, CLP Holdings and Mr. Wallinger, who through Countryside increased their collective percentage ownership in the Manchester property to 100%. Key issue to note here, the mere existence of the tax motivation and even the admission that the underlying transactions would not, as exactly structured, would not have taken place without the tax benefits being there, doesn't render the whole thing open to or render it automatically a loss on the economic substance attack. As the court noted, if there is truly economic change, there are different interests. Mr. Wynn and Mr. Curtis have interest-bearing notes, which are not the same as the property. Their economic interests changed. The partnership got rid of these potentially troublesome partners who might have objected to the sale. You know, there were real issues that took place aside from the tax motivation. If there is reality outside the tax motivation, the economic substance doctrine is not going to be applied. Now, the next question the IRS had was, were these notes marketable? The IRS attempted to claim that these notes were marketable securities as defined by 731C2BII. They claimed that the AIG promissory notes were readily convertible into cash or the marketable securities at the exiting partner's request. The IRS was concerned that the renegotiation option, though at the hearing, the IRS counsel agreed that a mere right to renegotiate isn't enough to convert notes into marketable securities, since otherwise any non-marketable note that failed to have a provision stating that the parties couldn't renegotiate it would fail, since obviously if you and I sign a note and we both decide we're going to go back to the table and change the terms together, we can do that legally. So the IRS agreed, but the IRS claimed that the existence of this provision made clear that there was a side agreement that everybody expected to be triggered. So based upon that there was some deal out there going on. Now, the IRS noted correspondence between AIG and the parties indicated AIG was willing to restructure the BP AIG notes in accordance with the instructions received from the prospective client's representative. And down the line, AIG would be willing to modify those notes in accordance with the purchaser's wishes, even at a possible financial loss. Now, I'll be honest, at first glance, that doesn't sound good. And frankly, those are facts I'm sure those representing the parties would have preferred were not nice little documents that came out in court about this case. What it does indicate, and I think in the back of our minds we have to remember, is the IRS does look beyond the literal notes. And marketing documents or things that are engaged in for these purposes, these types of documents are ones the IRS has become very interested in. And in many cases, the court has been interested in looking at for different purposes. But in this case, it didn't prove fatal. The tax court noted that AIG's willingness to consider a modification or repurchase of the AIG notes does not constitute evidence of an arrangement to convert the notes to cash marketable securities at MP's request, as it would be no more than standard business practice for a bank or financial institution to at least consider a customer's request to modify terms of the note. Moreover, Respondent's counsel has made no representation to the court that she is able to get Mr. Nelson or anyone else on behalf of AIG to testify it was AIG's practice to renegotiate the terms or repurchase its notes. Now, note that second clause there I'm now parenthetically inserting here. It might be a different rule if, in fact, the IRS had been able to show a history of this particular organization being involved in these transactions and always repurchasing the notes. In essence, if they'd been marketing this and pushing this to a number of people, and the IRS could put on the record that every time one of these was done, whenever the outgoing partners wanted the cash, they got it. Okay, another issue to realize. So there's important caveats with the facts in this case. That's what's always true with court cases. You have to be very careful looking at the exact facts used by the court to decide it. The court goes on to say, nor did AIG's willingness to structure and subsequently restructure the BP AIG notes in accordance with the customer's wishes at a probable overall loss on account of the transaction costs indicate the parties were not operating at arm's length then or later in connection with the AIG notes. An email from Mr. Nelson makes clear the willingness, and in particular the willingness to modify the note terms, was a business decision in that he hoped it would assure the customer's purchase of a second note from AIG. So AIG had a legitimate reason to, you know, consider restructuring this that had to do with other economic factors that were going to take place outside of this, not just merely making this transaction work. The court also did not find the fact these notes were used to secure a line of credit to give credence to the theory they were effectively marketable. The court noted, here again, the line of credit and the collateral transfer, including the pledge of the BP AIG notes, were all transactions negotiated between parties operated at arm's length. There's no evidence of any prior agreement between BP and AIG that the BP AIG notes would be used to secure the line of credit. And even if there had been, we do not agree that such an arrangement would have justified treating the BP AIG notes and by implication the AIG notes as marketable securities. It is common to use property, including personal residence, to secure a bank loan or line of credit, but that does not lead to the conclusion such property is readily convertible into or exchangeable for money or marketable securities. The IRS was now stuck with its final set of arguments. Those were the two anti-abuse regulation provisions to recast those transactions. Now, under the general anti-abuse rule of Regulation 1.701-2, the tax court indicated that given its holdings on the economic substance matter, the only issue remaining was whether the transaction violated the intent of Subchapter K. The court held that the IRS, by attributing gain to Mr. Wynn and Mr. Curtis on the deemed receipt of the AIG notes in exchange for their interest in Countryside, takes the position that the reporting of no gain on that transaction did not clearly reflect their income. Under Section 1.701-2B, Income Tax Regs, in cases in which there is not clear reflection of income, the commissioner may recast a transaction for federal income tax purposes if the partnership has been formed or availed of in a transaction the principal purpose of which is to reduce substantially the present value of the partner's aggregate federal income tax liability in a manner that is inconsistent with the intent of Subchapter K. Because we find the transaction, one, was imbued with economic substance, and two, did in fact result in Mr. Wynn and Mr. Curtis's receipt of non-marketable securities, we find the reporting of no gain on the receipt of the AIG note pursuant to Section 731A1 clearly reflected income from the transaction. Therefore, the IRS's reporting of the liquidation, therefore, the petitioners, I say, the taxpayers reporting the liquidation distribution as a distribution of property other than money may not be adjusted or modified pursuant to these regulations. Tax court also refused to use Regulation 1.731-2H to allow the IRS to tax a transaction, noting that the taxpayers argues on the basis of illustrated examples contained in Regulation 1.731-28 Income Tax Regs that the provisions should not have any application to a partnership that owns no marketable securities at all, either directly or indirectly. The IRS responds that describes that argument as expressing the untenable position that Section 1.731-28 does not apply to a situation where the partnerships create purportedly non-marketable securities to distribute in lieu of marketable securities or cash to avoid Section 731C. The court interpreted the IRS's statement as expressing tacit agreement with the taxpayer's position that if the AIG notes were not marketable securities as defined in Section 731C2, then Section 731-28 of the regs is inapplicable to deemed distribution of the AIG notes to Mr. Wynn and Mr. Curtis. Because we have concluded the AIG notes did not constitute marketable securities, we assume that the IRS would concede the Section 731-2H income tax regs is inapplicable to the distribution of these notes. Explicitly, the tax court did not find the examples in Section 1.731-2H, which the IRS cited as showing why this transaction should be recast, as apple to the situation. The court goes on to note, in any event, we agree with the taxpayers that each of the three examples contained in those regs, the first of which involves a change in partnership allocation distribution rights with respect to marketable securities, the second, a distribution of substantially all the partnership assets other than marketable securities, and the third, a distribution of multiple properties to one or more partners at different times, involve circumstances that are not present in these cases. We also note in the preamble to the final regulations under that section, the IRS, in response to a taxpayer request that there be examples illustrating abusive transactions tend to be covered by Section 731-28, stated that the text of the regulation adequately describes several situations that would be considered abusive, and additional examples are unnecessary. Thus, the examples contained in the regulations, which are the only portion of the text regulations describing situations which would be considered abusive, presumably illustrate the universe of circumstances considered abusive for purposes of 731C. My gut reaction is the IRS would not be terribly thrilled with that view of the way the reg was written or what was written in the preamble to the regulation, but nevertheless, that's what the court found. Now, at the end of the day, what have we learned from this particular case? Well, number one, it does tell us that the mere fact a taxpayer has motivation from a tax standpoint to structure a transaction in a particular fashion does not by itself render the transaction void for tax purposes. The IRS cannot simply say, aha, you had a bad motive, therefore we're going to ignore the transaction. If the taxpayer can show underlying true business reasons, not invented ones, we should say, and underlying true change in economic substance, not ones we're contriving to put together. As well, the case gives us an example of the fact that the court did consider the marketing materials and did consider, as we got in those AIG notes, I do consider it important to note that the court merely found that they didn't find an understanding existed, but they seemed to take particular time to note the fact the IRS didn't show there was arrangements for the company to redeem those notes regularly. That also tells me that if we have a situation where someone is structuring something and making use of some mechanism where there are numerous examples where that redemption has taken place and automatically occurs, you might have problems getting that by the court in this case. So be very careful of your facts. Finally, it reminds us of a rule that we sometimes forget, or people do, you know, those of us in practice, in general practice, who handle a lot of types of entities, sometimes get confused and forget just how flexible the partnership rules are and how easy it is to undo a partnership in a tax-free manner. And now we have to remember the hot asset rules that we didn't discuss here. Those can cause us some issues, but generally fewer issues than we're going to have with any other, with an entity, with any type of corporate entity where unwinding it tends to trigger gains all over the place. That's important when you're considering in formation what type of entity we should form. There is no question that this been a corporation, we wouldn't have unwound this nearly as nicely, or at least nothing like this form could have worked to unwind the transaction at no tax cost to the departing taxpayers and not forcing the continuing taxpayers, the continuing owners, to have to essentially absorb a tax as well, an additional level of tax. So it does illustrate for us the importance and the flexibility of partnerships and why we need to consider them when we look at planning and what an entity should select and what type of entity should be selected by a taxpayer for use in a business context. This has been the Tax Update for January 14th of 2008. As always, Tax Update is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Be sure to visit them for information of interest to tax practitioners. This is the Tax Update for January 14th, 2008.